good horse I call.
I'm sorry, but I don't want to be an emperor. That's not my business. I don't want to rule or conquer anyone. I should like to help everyone if possible. Jew, Gentile, black man, white. We all want to help one another. Human beings are like that. We want to live by each other's happiness, not by each other's misery. We don't want to hate and despise one another. In this world, there's room for everyone, and the good earth is rich and can provide for everyone. The way of life can be free and beautiful, but we have lost the way. Greed has poisoned men's souls, has barricaded the world with hate, has goose-stepped us into misery and bloodshed. We have developed speed, but we have shut ourselves in. Machinery that gives abundance has left us in want. Our knowledge has made us cynical, our cleverness hard and unkind. We think too much and feel too little. More than machinery, we need humanity. More than cleverness, we need kindness and gentleness. Without these qualities, life will be violent, and all will be lost. The aeroplane and the radio have brought us closer together. The very nature of these inventions cries out for the goodness in men, cries out for universal brotherhood, for the unity of us all. Even now, my voice is reaching millions throughout the world, millions of despairing men, women, and little children. Victims of a system that makes men torture and imprison innocent people. To those who can hear me, I say, do not despair. The misery that is now upon us is but the passing of greed, the bitterness of men who fear the way of human progress. The hate of men will pass and dictators die, and the power they took from the people will return to the people. And so long as men die, liberty will never perish. Soldiers, don't give yourselves to brutes, men who despise you, enslave you, who regiment your lives, tell you what to do, what to think, and what to feel, who drill you, diet you, treat you like cattle, use you as cannon fodder. Don't give yourselves to these unnatural men, machine men with machine minds and machine hearts. You are not machines. You are not cattle. You are men. You have the love of humanity in your hearts. You don't hate, only the unloved hate, the unloved and the unnatural. Soldiers, don't fight for slavery, fight for liberty. In the 17th chapter of St. Luke it is written, the kingdom of God is within man, not one man nor a group of men, but in all men, in you. You, the people, have the power to create machines, the power to create happiness. You, the people, have the power to make this life free and beautiful, to make this life a wonderful adventure. Then in the name of democracy, let us use that power. Let us all unite. Let us fight for a new world. A decent world that will give men a chance to work, that will give youth a future and old age a security. By the promise of these things, brutes have risen to power, but they lie. They do not fulfill that promise. They never will. Dictators free themselves, but they enslave the people. Now let us fight to fulfill that promise. Let us fight to free the world, to do away with national barriers, to do away with greed, with hate and intolerance. Let us fight for a world of reason, a world where science and progress will lead to all men's happiness. Soldiers, in the name of democracy, let us all unite!
You're listening to episode 608 of Unwelcome Guests. Flight from Meaning, Part 3. I'm Robin Upton, and that was a speech from Charlie Chaplin's The Great Dictator, which I hope will set a suitable tone for this show. Now, a slightly different show for you this week. It's more open-ended, more philosophical, not looking at the political themes, because somehow, underneath the details of how people choose to live their lives and how we choose to organize our interactions, there is another level, a deeper level of what we think life is about. What is life? More questions and answers this show. Now we're going to conclude our second hour with a new reading of John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education. He's describing his boyhood in Monongahela. Our main piece this week is a reading of philosopher Steve Talbot's essay, How Biologists Lost Sight of the Meaning of Life, Even Though It Was Staring Them in the Face. Now, last week we heard Alfie Cohn on the mound of evidence that human beings perform best when they're cooperating, and that competition is actually a harmful process, and especially how that mound of evidence has been ignored by those whose religion is competition. Now, looking closely at the economic system there, how that reduces a world of different concerns to a single dimension of information. How much do I get out of it? Now, Steve Talbot echoes what we heard about Cartesian dualism a couple of episodes ago, the discussion about whether animals feel pain. Now, Talbot's describing how modern academic rigor tells biologists, if you want to do proper science, then you can't talk about meaning. So any amount of details about molecules, but don't talk about what any of it actually means. Now, Talbot's essay was the inspiration for the title of this sequence of Unwelcome Guest episodes. This was not an easy piece to read. Actually, I had two goes at it, and I think it will probably stretch your listening muscles. I think he's getting at something quite fundamental here, how biologists in particular, but the rest of us by default, have been encouraged to deny meaning. There's an obvious overlap with the economic system here, in that if your worldview says, well, there is no meaning in anything, doesn't actually matter, then there is something of a void for how you decide what to do. If nothing means anything, isn't it all just chaos? Now, this is where the economic system leaps in to fill the gap and says, ah, there's no intrinsic meaning, but the meaning is, what can you get out of it? And it's a short life, you got to get the most out of it. Now, not only does that encourage people on a practical level to compete ruthlessly, it's on a more spiritual level, it's a very demeaning approach. I think one that, at least my heart, certainly rebels against. And so one that it's useful to be conscious of, lest we somehow get tricked into thinking, well, that's just the way life is, none of it actually means anything. Now, let's get going with the Steve Talbot reading. This is from an essay he published this year in a journal called Net Future, which I've linked to from this show's webpage, unwelcomeguest.net/608. How biologists lost sight of the meaning of life and are now staring it in the face. By Steve Talbot. What do we mean by meaning? The form of the question already suggests something amiss. Might we end up wandering in circles? After all, we must already know the meaning of a question before we can answer it. And beyond that, inquiries about the meaning of meaning might seem to launch us upon a mystifying pursuit of some inner essence or spiritual content we can never quite lay hold of. Perhaps this explains why so many biologists shun the idea that organisms engage in meaningful activity, that their lives can only be understood as lives of meaning. The idea may seem little more than a subjective and vaguely numinous obfuscation, threatening objective description and theory. You would make a rare find if you came upon an entry for meaning in the index of a biological textbook, even in examining a considerable shelf of anthologies on the philosophy of biology, books where difficult and even disreputable ideas are often brought up for discussion, I can discover not a single index listing for the word. And yet, asking about the meaning of things would seem to be the essence of science. Is there a biologist who doesn't routinely ask of his colleagues, "What do you mean by that?" And without any hint of irony in the question, or any slight tinge of anxiety about transgressing on forbidden territory. Apparently, biologists know quite well what they themselves mean by mean. This despite their apparent reluctance to employ the term in their science. It happens that human language, language in which the whole point is, in general, to learn what do you mean by that, is the vehicle through which all our science is articulated. There could be no textbooks without our ability to get meaning as a matter of course. Perhaps the point has been too blindingly obvious to notice. If we understand the world through the meanings of the language we set down in scientific textbooks, if we believe these meanings to be more or less true of the world, then we must believe that the world is meaningful, that it is, in some sense, language-like. If, then, meaning is felt alien to our molecular biological understanding of organisms, my current topic, we might wonder whether the problem really lies with the idea of meaning itself, or rather pertains to an aberrant force of repulsion the term exerts upon the scientific mind, a mind that nevertheless seems intended for nothing so much as apprehending the most subtle and enlivening meanings. Seeing from our own point of view. Where do we look for an understanding of life? Where, if anywhere, does life put its own meaning on display most forthrightly and clearly? There is one high promontory within the sprawling panorama of life on Earth that does indeed afford a perspective upon the whole, a place from where the unique processes occurring throughout the kingdoms of life become peculiarly visible, manifesting their significance. There is, we can know without a doubt, one evolutionary achievement that offers not only an unlimited survey of the entire drama of life, but also lends itself to the penetrating insight we need for recognizing and expressing the many meaningful aspects of the drama. This evolutionary achievement lies in the place we know best, in fact, the only place where the necessary sort of knowing occurs at all. It is where life becomes conscious of itself, where the living creature not only acts out its own significant existence, but is capable of contemplating this existence, along with that of all other living things. It is the one outgrowth within the great age-old tree of life, where life's own power of survey blossoms and reaches its fullest fruition, the understanding consciousness of man. The mind's tragic refusal of itself. In man, nature herself becomes conscious and finds a voice. The creative forces at work in evolution, whatever they may be, achieve a vantage point of earthly awareness, a place where the intelligence, the thoughts, visible in leaf and worm, in gene expression and signaling pathways, in molluscan responsiveness and mammalian deliberation, can at least begin coming to conscious expression in the lucid and focused understanding of the individual human being. When, then, we direct our understanding to the very organic phenomena through which it arose, what we see is our own reason reflected back to us in its developing, not yet conscious form, manifesting itself objectively in the material instruments that will become the basis for its future conscious expression. Every biologist who endeavors faithfully to enter into the life of another organism and to offer an account of her discoveries is, in an obvious and straightforward sense, reporting a double content, that of her own mind, which is at the same time a content belonging objectively to the given organism. To believe in the possibilities of science is to accept the commensurability of the two contents. We've benefited from many conscientious accounts of this sort. For example, from a woman of indomitable spirit, Jane Goodall, who spent decades living in chimpanzee society in order to enter sympathetically and truthfully into the reality of it. From the great entomologists such as Jean-Henri Fabre, who brought the world of insects alive for us, and Carl von Frisch, who patiently deciphered the language of the dance of bees. From Adolf Portmann, the eminent zoologist who, in his Animal Forms and Patterns, taught us something about the language of animal appearance, and from one of the finest observers of all, Charles Darwin, who, among many other studies, once wrote a treatise on the marvellous industry and habits of the earthworm. These were explorers whose receptive minds were flexible instruments to open the mind-like, the meaningful, the striving, the expressive and purposeful in other creatures. We're pausing the Steve Talbot reading for a bit because he refers to Dr. Jane Goodall, whom I looked up online to see what she had to say about chimpanzees and found the following TED recording from 2007.
I came directly here from the deep, deep tropical rainforest in Ecuador, where I was out, you could only get there by a plane, with indigenous people with paint on their faces and parrot feathers on their headdresses, where these people are fighting to try and keep the oil companies and keep the roads out of their forests. They're fighting to develop their own way of living within the forest in a world that's clean, a world that isn't contaminated, a world that isn't polluted. There, right in the middle of this rainforest, was some solar panels, the first in that part of Ecuador, and that was mainly to bring water up by pump so that the women wouldn't have to go down. The water was cleaned, but because they got a lot of batteries, they were able to store a lot of electricity. So every house, and there were, I think, 8 houses in this little community, could have light for, I think it was about 30 minutes each evening. And there is the chief in all his regal finery with a laptop computer. And this man, he has been outside, but he's gone back. And he was saying, you know, we have suddenly jumped into a whole new era. And we didn't even know about the white man 50 years ago. Now here we are with laptop computers. And there are some things we want to learn from the modern world. We want to know about health care. We want to know about what other people do. We're interested in it. And we want to learn other languages. We want to know English and French and perhaps Chinese, and we're good at languages. So there he is with his little laptop computer, but fighting against the might of the pressures because of the debt, the foreign debt of Ecuador, fighting the pressure of World Bank, IMF, and of course the people who want to exploit the forests and take out the oil. So coming directly from there to here, but of course my real field of expertise lies in an even different kind of civilization. I can't really call it a civilization, a different way of life from a different being. And I propose to bring into this TED conference, as I always do around the world, the voice of the animal kingdom. Too often we just see a few slides or a bit of film, but these beings have voices that mean something. And so I want to give you a greeting as from a chimpanzee in the forest of Tanzania. I've been studying chimpanzees in Tanzania since 1960. During that time, there have been modern technologies that have really transformed the way that field biologists do their work. For example, for the first time a few years ago, by simply collecting little fecal samples, we were able to have them analyzed, to have DNA profiling done. So for the first time, we actually know which male chimps are the fathers of each individual infant, because the chimps have a very promiscuous mating society. So this opens up a whole new avenue of research. And we use GSI to determine the range of the chimps, and we're using, you can see that I'm not really into this kind of stuff, but we're using satellite imagery to look at the deforestation in the area, and of course there's developments in infrared so you can watch animals at night, and equipment for recording by video and tape recording is getting lighter and better. So in many, many ways, we can do things today that we couldn't do when I began in 1960. Especially when chimpanzees and other animals with large brains are studied in captivity, modern technology is helping us to search for the upper levels of cognition in some of these non-human animals, so that we know today they're capable of performances that would have been thought absolutely impossible by science when I began. I think the chimpanzee in captivity who is the most skilled in intellectual performance is one called Ai in Japan. Her name means love, and she has a wonderfully sensitive partner working with her. She loves her computer. She'll leave her big group and her running water and her trees and everything, and she'll come in to sit at this computer. It's like a video game for a kid. She's hooked. She's 28, by the way. And she does things with her computer screen with a touchpad that she can do faster than most humans. She does very complex tasks, and I haven't got time to go into them. But the amazing thing about this female is she doesn't like making mistakes. If she has a bad run and her score isn't good, she'll come and reach up and tap on the glass because she can't see the experimenter, which is asking to have another go. And her concentration, she's already concentrated hard for 20 minutes or so, and now she wants to do it all over again just for the satisfaction of having done it better. And the food is not important. She does get a tiny reward, like one raisin, for a correct response, but she will do it for nothing if you tell her beforehand. So, you know, so here we are, a chimpanzee using a computer. Chimpanzees, gorillas, orangutans also learn human sign language. But the point is that when I was first in Gombe in 1960, I remember so well, so vividly, as though it was yesterday, the first time when I was going through the vegetation, the chimpanzees were still running away from me for the most part, although some were a little bit acclimatized. And I saw this dark shape hunched over a termite mound. I peered with my binoculars. It was, fortunately, one adult male whom I'd named David Greybeard. And by the way, science at that time was telling me that I shouldn't name the chimps. They should all have numbers. That was more scientific. Anyway, David Greybeard. And I saw that he was picking little pieces of grass and using them to fish termites from their underground nest. And not only that, he would sometimes pick a leafy twig and strip the leaves, modifying an object to make it suitable for a specific purpose, the beginning of tool making. The reason this was so exciting and such a breakthrough is at that time, it was thought that humans and only humans used and made tools. When I was at school, we were defined as man, the toolmaker. So that when Louis Leakey, my mentor, heard this news, he said, ah, we must now redefine man, redefine tool, or accept chimpanzees as humans. We now know that at Gombe alone, there are 9 different ways in which chimpanzees use different objects for different purposes. Moreover, we know that in different parts of Africa, wherever chimps have been studied, there are completely different tool-using behaviors. And because it seems that these patterns are passed from one generation to the next through observation, imitation, and practice, that is a definition of human culture. What we find is that over these 40-odd years that I and others have been studying chimpanzees and the other great apes, and as I say, other mammals with complex brains and social systems, we have found that after all, there isn't a sharp line dividing humans from the rest of the animal kingdom. It's a very wuzzy line. It's getting wuzzier all the time as we find animals doing things that we, in our arrogance, used to think was just human. The chimps, there's no time to discuss their fascinating lives, but they have this long childhood, 5 years of suckling and sleeping with the mother, and then another 3, 4, or 5 years of emotional dependence on her even when the next child is born. The importance of learning in that time when behavior is flexible and there's an awful lot to learn in chimpanzee society. The long-term affectionate supportive bonds that develop throughout this long childhood with the mother, with the brothers and sisters, and which can last through a lifetime which may be up to 60 years. They can actually live longer than 60 in captivity. So we've only done 40 years in the wild so far. And we find chimps are capable of true compassion and altruism. We find in their non-verbal communication, this is very rich, they have a lot of sounds which they use in different circumstances, but they also use touch, posture, gesture. And what do? They kiss, they embrace, they hold hands, they pat one another on the back, they swagger, they shake their fist. The kind of things that we do, and they do them in the same kind of context. They have very sophisticated cooperation. Sometimes they hunt, not that often, but when they hunt, they show sophisticated cooperation, and they share the prey. we find that they show emotions similar to, maybe sometimes the same, as those that we describe in ourselves as happiness, sadness, fear, despair. They know mental as well as physical suffering, and I don't have time to go into the information that would prove some of these things to you, save to say that there are very bright students in the best universities studying emotions in animals, studying personalities in animals. We know that chimpanzees and some other creatures can recognize themselves in mirrors, self as opposed to other. They have a sense of humor. And these are the kind of things which traditionally have been thought of as human prerogatives. But this teaches us a new respect, and it's a new respect not only for the chimpanzees, I suggest, but some of the other amazing animals with whom we share this planet. Once we're prepared to admit that, after all, we're not the only beings with personalities, minds, and above all, feelings, and then we start to think about ways we use and abuse so many other sapient creatures on this planet, it really gives cause for deep shame, at least for me. So the sad thing is that these chimpanzees, who've perhaps taught us more than any other creature a little humility, are in the wild disappearing very fast. They're disappearing for the reasons that all of you in this room know only too well: the deforestation, the growth of human populations needing more land. They're disappearing because some timber companies go in with clear cutting. They're disappearing in the heart of their range in Africa because the big multinational logging companies have come in and made roads, as they want to do in Ecuador and other parts where the forests remain untouched, to take out oil or timber. And this has led in Congo Basin and other parts of the world to what's known as the bushmeat trade. This means that although for hundreds, perhaps thousands of years, people have lived in those forests or whatever habitat it is in harmony with their world, just killing the animals they need for themselves and their families, now suddenly, because of the roads, the hunters can go in from the towns. They shoot everything, every single thing that moves that's bigger than a small rat. They sun-dry it or smoke it. Now they've got transport. They take it on the logging trucks or the mining trucks into the towns where they sell it. And people will pay more for bushmeat, as it's called, than for domestic meat. It's culturally preferred. And it's not sustainable. And the huge logging camps in the forest are now demanding meat. So the pygmy hunters in the Congo Basin, who've lived there with their wonderful way of living for so many hundreds of years, are now corrupted. They're given weapons. They shoot for the logging camps. They get money. Their culture is being destroyed, along with the animals upon whom they depend. So when the logging camp moves, there's nothing left. We talked already about the loss of human cultural diversity, and I've seen it happening with my own eyes. And the grim picture in Africa, I love Africa. And what do we see in Africa? We see deforestation. We see the desert spreading. We see massive hunger. We see disease. We see population growth in areas where there are more people living on a certain piece of land than the land can possibly support, and they're too poor to buy food from elsewhere. Where the people that we heard about yesterday on the Easter Island who cut down their last tree, were they stupid? Didn't they know what was happening? Of course, but if you've seen the crippling poverty in some of these parts of the world, it isn't a question of let's leave the tree for tomorrow. How am I going to feed my family today? Maybe I can get just a few dollars from this last tree, which will keep us going a little bit longer, and then we'll pray that something will happen to save us from the inevitable end. So this is a pretty grim picture. The one thing we have which makes us so different from chimpanzees or other living creatures is this sophisticated spoken language, a language with which we can tell children about things that aren't here. We can talk about the distant past, plan for the distant future, discuss ideas with each other so that the ideas can grow from the accumulated wisdom of a group. We can do it by talking to each other. We can do it through video. We can do it through the written word. And we are abusing this great power we have to be wise stewards. And we're destroying the world. in the developed world, it's in a way it's worse because we have so much access to knowledge of the stupidity of what we're doing. Do you know, we're bringing little babies into a world where in many places the water is poisoning them and the air is harming them and the food that's grown from the contaminated land is poisoning them. And that's not just in the far away developing world, that's everywhere. Do you know we all have about 50 chemicals in our bodies we didn't have about 50 years ago? And so many of these diseases like asthma and certain kinds of cancers are on the increase around places where our filthy, toxic waste is dumped. We're harming ourselves around the world, as well as harming the animals, as well as harming nature herself, Mother Nature that brought us into being. Mother Nature, where I believe we need to spend time with us, trees and flowers and birds, for our good psychological development. And yet there are hundreds and hundreds of children in the developed world who never see nature, because they're growing up in concrete and all they know is virtual reality with no opportunity to go and lie in the sun or in the forest with the dappled sun specks coming down from the canopy above. As I was traveling around the world, you know, I had to leave the forest. That's where I love to be. I had to leave these fascinating chimpanzees for my students and field staff to continue studying, because finding they dwindled from about 2 million 100 years ago to about 150,000 now, I knew I had to leave the forest to do what I could to raise awareness around the world. And the more I talked about the chimpanzees' plight, the more I realized the fact that everything's interconnected and the problems of the developing world so often stem from the greed of the developed world. And everything was joining together and making not sense. Hope lies in sense, you said. It's making a nonsense. How can we do it? Somebody said that yesterday. And as I was traveling around, I kept meeting young people who'd lost hope. They were feeling despair. They were feeling, well, it doesn't matter what we do, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Everything's hopeless. We're always being told so by the media. And then I met some who were angry, an anger that can turn to violence. And we're all familiar with that. And I have three little grandchildren. When some of these students would say to me, high school or university, they'd say we're angry or we're filled with despair because we feel you've compromised our future and there's nothing we can do about it. And I looked in the eyes of my little grandchildren and think how much we've harmed this planet since I was their age. I feel this deep shame. And that's why in 1991 in Tanzania, I started a program that's called Roots and Shoots. There's little brochures all around outside. And if any of you have anything to do with children and care about their future, I beg that you pick up that brochure. And Roots and Shoots is a program for hope. Roots make a firm foundation. Shoots seem tiny, but to reach the sun, they can break through brick walls. See the brick walls as all the problems that we've inflicted on this planet. Then you see it is a message of hope. Hundreds and thousands of young people around the world can break through and can make this a better world. And the most important message of Roots and Shoots is that every single individual makes a difference. Every individual has a role to play. Every one of us impacts the world around us every day. And you scientists know that you can't actually, even if you stay in bed all day, you're breathing oxygen and giving out CO2 and probably going to the loo and things like that, you're making a difference in the world. So the Roots and Shoots program involves youth in three kinds of projects. And these are projects to make the world around them a better place. One project to show care and concern for your own human community. One for animals, including domestic animals. And I have to say, I learned everything I know about animal behavior even before I got to Gombe and the chimps from my dog, Rusty, who was my childhood companion. And the third kind of project, something for the local environment. So what the kids do depends, first of all, how old are they? And we go now from preschool right through university. It's going to depend whether they're inner city or rural. It's going to depend if they're wealthy or impoverished. It's going to depend which part, say, of America they're in. We're in every state now, and the problems in Florida are different from the problems in New York. It's going to depend on which country they're in, and we're already in 60 plus countries with about 5,000 active groups. Only there are groups all over the place that I keep hearing about that I've never even heard of because the kids are taking the program and spreading it themselves. Why? Because they're buying into it and they're the ones who get to decide what they're going to do. It isn't something that their parents tell them or their teachers tell them. That's effective. But if they decide themselves, we want to clean this river and put the fish back that used to be there. We want to clear away the toxic soil from this area and have an organic garden. We want to go and spend time with the old people and hear their stories and record their oral histories. We want to go and work in a dog shelter. We want to learn about animals. We want to, you know, it goes on and on. And this is very hopeful for me. As I travel around the world 300 days a year, everywhere there's a group of roots and shoots of different ages. Everywhere there are children with shining eyes saying, look at the difference we've made. And now comes the technology into it, because with this new way of communicating electronically, these kids can communicate with each other around the world. And if anyone's interested to help us, we've got so many ideas, but we need help. We need help to create the right kind of system that will help these young people to communicate their excitement, but also, and this is so important, to communicate their despair, to say, we've tried this, and it doesn't work, and what should we do? And then, lo and behold, there's another group answering these kids who may be in America, maybe this is a group in Israel, saying, yeah, you did it a little bit wrong. This is how you should do it. The philosophy is very simple. We do not believe in violence. No violence, no bombs, no guns. That's not the way to solve problems. Violence leads to violence, at least in my view. So how do we solve? The tools for solving the problems are knowledge and understanding. Know the facts, but see how they fit in the big picture. Hard work and persistence. Don't give up. And love and compassion leading to respect for all life. So basically, Roots and Shoots is beginning to change young people's lives. It's what I'm devoting most of my energy to. But the kids do ask me, and this it won't take more than 2 minutes, I promise. The kids say, Dr. Jane, do you really have hope for the future? You travel, you see all these horrible things happening. Firstly, the human brain. I don't need to say anything about that. Now that we know what the problems are around the world, human brains like yours are rising to solve those problems. And we've talked a lot about that. Secondly, the resilience of nature. We can destroy a river and we can bring it back to life. We can see a whole area desolated and it can be brought back to bloom again with time or a little help. And thirdly, we are surrounded by the most amazing people who do things that seem to be absolutely impossible. Nelson Mandela, I take a little piece of limestone from Robben Island Prison where he labored for 27 years and came out with so little bitterness. He could lead his people from the horror of apartheid without a bloodbath. Even after the 11th of September, and I was in New York, and I felt the fear. Nevertheless, there was so much human courage, so much love, and so much compassion. And then as I went around the country after that and felt the fear that was leading to people feeling they couldn't worry about the environment anymore in case they seemed not to be patriotic, and I was trying to encourage them, somebody came up with a little quotation from Mahatma Gandhi. If you look back through human history, you see that every evil regime has been overcome by good. And just after that, a woman brought me this little bell, and I want to end on this note. She said, if you're talking about hope and peace, ring this. This bell is made from metal, from a diffused landmine, from the killing fields of Pol Pot. one of the most evil regimes in human history, where people are now beginning to put their lives back together after the regime has crumbled. So, yes, there is hope. And where is the hope? Is it out there with the politicians? It's in our hands. It's in your hands and my hands and those of our children. It's really up to us. We're the ones who can make a difference. If we lead lives where we consciously leave the lightest possible ecological footprints, if we buy the things that are ethical for us to buy and don't buy the things that are not, we can change the world overnight. Thank you.
Well, and with Jane Goodall, as far as personal responsibility goes, I'm not sure about buying or not buying. My heart tells me that, in a sense, it is demeaning to try and equate different things with each other, and certainly the use of money, an abstract and currently hierarchically controlled system, while it is certainly habitual, I don't think counts as natural at all. And now let's get back to Steve Talbot. This section is called The Mind's Tragic Refusal of Itself. But tragedy intervened, for in biology there has also occurred what may be the greatest self-effacement of all time. Precisely at the point in evolutionary history where the understanding consciousness arises and becomes aware of itself, it begins to deny its own powers. We are those who, by grace of our evolutionary inheritance, can, in one way or another, enter into the meaning of the life of every living creature and make it our own. Yet, fearing anthropocentrism, which is to say fearing ourselves, we end up belittling the gift of understanding. In biology, the result is that meaning itself has become a forbidden word, a shameful sign of the loss of hard-headed rigor. This is especially true since the discovery of the double helix in 1953 and the triumph of molecular biology. Naturalists have given way to rote data gatherers and lab technicians. Nearly all the symbols by which we can most richly forge a cognitive connection to the world, by which we can invite the world to speak in us, have been derogated, with only the most demeaned ones retaining respectability. Mathematics, information, algorithm, code, computation, the abstracted logical structure of mechanisms, never mind that these too are expressions of our own consciousness and mentality, have become the only philosophically pure terms of biological discourse. The organism is denied a full voice on Earth through our refusal to lend it the full expressive powers of our own voice. As for the dangers of anthropocentrism, yes, there are such dangers. Projecting ourselves onto other creatures as if they were blank screens is always a temptation. But, I would say, an equal danger today is quite the opposite. We are oi anthropoi, and it is therefore our obligation to be properly anthropocentric, to exercise our own potentials rather than to project onto ourselves and fellow organisms the character of particular mechanical products of our own activity. Scientists wish to understand life. Wouldn't it be far better if they brought to bear upon this life the full expressive powers of the living, cognizing thought through which we conceive and build machines, rather than constrain their thinking to the deadened terms of the contrived objects? It is indeed a tragedy. Where life finally begins to gain self-awareness, that awareness turns against itself, reduces itself to bytes and mechanisms, and employs its cleverest powers of meaning in order to deny the very fact of meaning. Can we say what meaning is? In an essay dealing with the supposed randomness of mutations relative to evolutionary fitness, I suggested that the importance of randomness in the minds of many is, quote, due to its being the only presumed scrap of a weapon in a compulsive struggle to deny all the obvious meaning of our lives, unquote. This brought the following response from a wise and prominent evolutionary thinker, one who seemed sympathetic to my trend of thought, but who also wanted to push me toward greater clarity. Sorry to be boorish, But is the obvious meaning of our lives specifiable? If the question turns on whether we can meaningfully describe any person, organism, or thing, then I would answer that we can always make a start at such a description, and, happily, we can never make an end of it. In observing the rose, we may note its colour and beauty, its water and sap-transporting processes, its thorny power of rending, its changing appearance under sunlight, shade, and moonlight, its unique relationship with each insect among its circle of animal companions, the scent of its flowers, its way of reflecting the world in a dewdrop, the distinctive pattern of its root growth, its cellular metabolism from one cell type to another, the sour taste of its fruits, and much, much more. And we may hope to glimpse, running through all these features, the unity that constrains the entire ensemble to perform qualitatively and harmoniously as this kind of plant, and not another. No human biography or characterization of a plant is ever complete, but neither are we absolutely barred from any understanding we may seek. That is the way with meaning. We can always plumb it more deeply or from different angles. Meaning is never a fixed quantity, but always opens out onto the entire universe of meaning. Text and context are inseparable, and if we know enough to ask a halfway coherent question, then in the very framing of the question, we have already found our way towards some of the understanding we seek. But if what my interlocutor was questioning is the fact or nature of meaning as such, by what right do you use the word meaning in science at all? And what exactly are you referring to with the word? Then we're brought directly up against the problem I mentioned at the outset. How do we talk about the meaning of meaning without wandering in circles? The problem is actually not as difficult as it looks, or it wouldn't be if our scientific culture hadn't long been fleeing the very fact of meaning so compulsively. Gestures that speak. There was a time when I thought the topic of meaning required a deep dive into philosophical subtlety. Such an exercise may indeed be useful, but I now suspect that the more important thing is simply to notice the obvious. Even the most brilliant scientists are human beings who play, work, get married, get sick, get angry, write papers, defend those papers, vote in elections, watch movies, tell jokes, argue for justice, pursue their own projects, join choirs, face death with uncertainty, and so on. Any biologists who claim that they, as full participants in and exemplars of our planet's evolutionary drama, spend anything less than full-time living out meaning in their lives, or who assert that their scientific work is anything but an elaboration of their own meanings, an extremely disciplined elaboration which they hope will be faithful to the world's meanings, well, to begin with, we'd have to dismiss their words as gibberish, rather than as vehicles of meaning. We are nothing but creatures of meaning. We never make a movement that isn't a meaningful gesture. One that the psychiatrist, physical therapist, student of temperaments, sociologist, stage director, and all the rest of us can read with more or less success. Even an infant, in its own way, finds significance in the most subtle human movements. Any infant who is not raised in a speaking environment fails to develop anything like normal human capacities, and speaking environment refers to the meaning implicit in every significant gesture. Before they themselves can speak, infants take an interest in and learn to read gestures, to the point of distinguishing, in silent videos, between speakers of two languages they've never heard before. Meaning is just there, whether we speak words or not. Every act of ours is a signifying. And we collectively understand each other's meanings well enough to engender civilizations that are infinitely complex tapestries woven from those meanings. Even the bee dance referred to above is purposeful speech, freighted with meaning for the hive, however unconscious and objectified. The way a deer, motionless, gazes at you from a distance while waiting for a sign of imminent danger or a return to normalcy is meaningful speech. and its meaning is immediately read by the other deer in the group, who also cease feeding and take up the attentive gaze. The newborn offspring of many mammals read and learn from every slightest behavioural suggestion of their parents or mentors. Here, then, is my question for the sceptic. Where, in the pervasive matrix of meaning I've just characterised, do you find an unscientific obscurantism? More particularly, which of the meanings you speak and understand and found your life upon and discover in other creatures is a puzzle to you? I would like to know the precise nature of the disreputable element in these meanings you live by. For example, in all the words you've spoken, understood, and been willing to respond to today. This collection of words, I'm sure, goes far beyond the more acceptable technical terms of any particular science. Yet, apart from specially deserving cases, you don't recoil from such words in disgust. Escaping circularity. Perhaps you will insist that I rigorously define the meaning of meaning, and will say that until I do, I have no right to make the word part of a philosophical or scientific text. It's true that we must always work at clarifying our meanings, and I suppose that if this didn't apply to the word meaning itself, I wouldn't be writing this article. But to demand a definition at this point, to ask for the meaning of meaning, is actually to run away from it. Meaning is where we start from. We cannot define it, because meanings are what we employ in order to define things. To ask what meaning means is like trying to prove the validity of the logic we use in the proofs. As human beings, we must, and do every day, simply wake up to meaning. If we possess cognitive capacities, even as infants, it can only be because these capacities are themselves products of the world's play of meaning. Call it the logos, if you wish, through which you and I have come into being. So, asking about the meaning of meaning doesn't send us in a circle. It returns us to our origin, and to the immediately given character of the world that produced the deer and the bee and us. Even those for whom this is a forbidden truth cannot seem to help confirming it. In 1977, the eminent physicist Steven Weinberg uttered what would become one of the most quoted remarks of our day when he said, quote, "The more the universe seems comprehensible, the more it also seems pointless." Unquote. The statement is startlingly oxymoronic. Things become comprehensible in a scientific sense precisely by losing their pointlessness. Their comprehensibility is nothing other than their meaningfulness. By pointless, Weinberg later explained, he meant not particularly directed toward human beings. But what does that mean? Surely we don't need or want the universe pointing to us in some selfish sense, but when we comprehend things, when we are joined to them in an act of understanding, they lend themselves to the intimacy of our innermost being. Their sensibility becomes our own. A universe that gives itself to us in this way does not seem to have the chilling, cold, impersonal quality that Weinberg finds in it. Actually, you couldn't find more anthropomorphic, which is to say more humanly meaningful terms, than chilling, cold, and impersonal. Weinberg, one happily notes, has not entirely fled his own humanity, and we doubtless do run into things we justly describe with the qualities he discerns, thereby relating them to our inner life and discovering something about their character. It's just that these are not the only or even the most common qualities human beings find when they gaze, fully informed, into a starry sky or the teeming protoplasm of a living cell. Weinberg's stance is not at all uncommon. It reminds us how easy it is today for scientists to live so hopelessly confined within their own carefully crafted edifice of theoretical constructs, their own intentionally narrowed meanings, that they no longer notice the fullness of the world they started out trying to understand. That world, its tangible, threatening, pungent, inescapable, grounding, uplifting presence, is conjured away by the analytical tools and impoverished models of a one-sided science. The aim of the whole endeavour is forgotten, an aim we might express with T.S. Eliot's familiar lines from Four Quartets. We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started, and know the place for the first time. A gentle suggestion. If we cannot define meaning, what are we doing when we ask what someone means? Apparently, what we're asking for is not something neatly packageable or nailed down like, like a dictionary definition. But of course, dictionary definitions do not nail down anything at all. They define words by using other words, and simply assume that we will be able to dance our way into the midst of the circling words by moving in tune with the meanings we already possess and improvising upon them. Meaning of any significance is never something we can hand someone definitively, because each word we speak depends upon and participates in all the others. We can never say of any profound meaning, "There, I've got it." Meaning is a journey. We can only track meaning as we might track the blossoming of a flower, getting to know it better and better, even as we continually lose its old form and must rediscover its truth, newly metamorphosed. The English philologist Owen Barfield reminded us that we can suggest meaning, but we cannot convey it as though it were a bit of information biologists are so fond of. This is why, as Barfield magnificently demonstrated, our grasp of new meaning is typically mediated by figurative or metaphorical language, language that can only encourage and assist us towards exercising our own powers for intuiting the content at issue. We do not transmit information, we assist at the birth of insight. Virtually all scientific language, gravity, matter, stimulus, as Barfield illustrates, also originates in figurative usage. We can, for example, watch how the idea of a scientific law emerged, albeit in a Latin text, in Francis Bacon's introduction of the concept. He advised his readers to abandon the conventional forms of nature and to think instead metaphorically in terms of humanly legislated laws. The metaphor was, in fact, a real stretch, demanding much of its hearers. In his Novum Organum, published in 1620, Bacon wrote, quote, "It may be that nothing really exists except individual bodies, which produce real motion according to law. In science, it is just that law, and inquiry, discovery, and explanation of it, which are the fundamental requisite both for the knowledge and for the control of nature. And it is that law and its clauses, which I mean when I use, chiefly because of its current prevalence and familiarity, the word forms." Unquote. We need to imagine the situation. Readers who had never heard of scientific law, or anything resembling our modern notion of it, were advised to think, for the first time, of nature obeying something like the Acts of Parliament. They were expected to intuit whatever truth might be hidden in that literal nonsense. We can get a worthy metaphor only if its way of suggesting is already recognized as a meaningful gesture, that is, only if we not only grasp the literal untrue sense of the metaphor, but also the necessity for looking through it to the intended meanings to which it gestures. Gesture with your finger at something, and your very literal-minded dog will most likely just look curiously at your finger, all the more as you start waving wildly and impatiently. As always, the apprehension of meaning is rooted in nothing more fundamental than, or prior to, the apprehension of meaning. The intended meaning of a novel metaphor may be one we don't already know, and the metaphor certainly does not define it for us. It invites us, through suggestion, to embrace the active possibility and responsibility of recognizing new and previously hidden relations between things, which is our birthright and the foundation of all understanding.